Making Choices in the Context of a Modern World, Women Against Women, is the title of the paper to be presented during this session. But first, a few words about its author. Marie Cornwall is Associate Professor of Sociology and Director of the Women's Research Institute at Brigham Young University. She's given numerous scholarly papers and published extensively. Many of you are familiar with her periodic columns in Sunstone. While I enjoy her insights and sense of humor, the most intriguing thing about Marie is that she is the possessor of hidden knowledge of about Mormons that even those of us most devoid of even those of us most devoid of curiosity would love to know. Right? Listen to a partial list of the unpublished studies she has done for the church's Research and Evaluation Division. Adolescent faith development, religious activity in the British Isles, the activation process, church magazine study, profile of three-member activity types, single study, evaluation of current activation programs, factors related to organizational performance in wards, religious activity among Latter-day Saints. Yeah. Knowing Marie, I am confident she will remain professionally circumspect about revealing any of this privileged information today. However, Albert assures me that her presentations are all that her presentations always reflect her research. Marie.
Thank you. That's the first time I've ever been introduced by reading the unpublished things. A few weeks ago, Albert called me and said he'd gone through all of his possible lists of plenary speakers. And still didn't have one, and was in a real crisis. And egotist that I am, I said, well, you know, I've been sort of playing with some ideas, and this will give me a chance to sort of put them together. So I volunteered myself. So those of you who want to do this, if there's any of you out there, I just suggest you call Albert next time and get on that list. I'm going to attempt to do something. I don't have a prepared sort of speech I'm going to read. Mostly what I want to talk to you about is a number of different ideas that have been coming together for me. I always like these opportunities because they make me put ideas that are long in the back of my head together to share and get some feedback. I'm going to do three things today. I want to first remind us, and I really mean remind us because most of us have lived through a good portion of these years, of the tremendous amount of social and structural change that has occurred in the last 30 years in the United States with regards to women's lives and experience. I think it will remind us that society is changing and not just ideology, and that the two are somehow interconnected, that there are important structural forces out there creating a new world in which we live, and that the implications for women are far stronger, I think, than for, at least so far, than for the experience of men. The second thing I want to do is discuss the sociological implications of these changes, the lack of knowledge, so to speak, in sociological theories about women, and the need to look at how women are creating their own personal worldview or paradigm that guides their lives. Basically, what I want to point out is that both socialization theories and structuralist theories, which have in the past attempted and described women's lives, are simply not adequate. And I'll try not to get too sociological in that sense, but I think you need to understand that. And then finally, I want to pull this all together and examine why this might be significant for LDS women. Now, I'm going to start with a few slides to remind us of the change that has occurred in society and where those changes are coming from. The first slide this is basically from census data. The first slide just tells us that not just in 30 years, but in the last 25 years, there's been a dramatic increase in the educational attainment of women in the U.S. population in general. If you look at these numbers, you can see that between 1975 and 1987, a 12-year period, we have upwards of law degrees presenting to women gets up to over 35%. Medicine, over 30%. Dentistry, over 20%. Theological schools these days are filled with women who are studying theology. Law schools, medical schools. How does this relate to LDS women? Let me give you some statistics from BYU. If you look at 1982 commencements, all of the commencements in 1982, 59% of the baccalaureate degrees were given to men, and 41% were given to women in 1982. By 1991, 53% were given to men and 47% to women. Now that shows a 6% shift, which may or may not be significant depending on your perspective, but we're moving towards a 50-50, which has been true in the country at large since the mid-80s. To give you even more idea of the shift that's taking place, however, it's better to look at completion rates over like a 10-year period, because so you can look at the entering freshman class, how many graduated after 10 years. And at BYU, we have to do 10 years because they go on missions and they get married. And they seem to be taking longer. If there's any indication, by the way, in my Sociology of Mormonism class this year, of 30 students, I have three pregnant women who, and they're all going to have their children before the semester is over. One already had, a couple of weeks ago, a premature birth cesarean section and missed a week of class. I told her she could stay home. And there are two more that will deliver any time. So part of the reason that completion rate is low is because our students, despite the fact that marriage rates are moving up, or the age of marriage is moving up for Mormon populations, you still find these students getting married and starting their families. The difference is that the women are not dropping out. And we found that in a six-year period, and it's the same period that's being represented there in the early 80s, where you get this huge shift, that we basically doubled the percent of women who were completing their degrees at BYU. The gap between men and women in terms of completion was reduced by 57% in a six-year period. That's a tremendous amount of change, which says to me that these women, these changes I'm talking about happen to LDS women as well as other women. Now, let's look at labor force participation, how that has changed. Okay, does that work? Labor force participation married women, husband present. We usually use this based on the old model that once a woman marries, she doesn't need to provide her own support. But you can see the tremendous change that occurred since 1950 and 1990. Now, where we go from 20% up to about 58%. Just to put this a little bit more in perspective, my mother gave birth to her third child in 1949, a lovely bouncing baby girl. When she looked around her, all her friends and acquaintances who were having children were at home raising those children. I have a sister who is pregnant and will have a child in June. It will be her third child. She is in her second year of law school. Her husband is completing his third year of law school. In a period of 1 month, they're going to graduate him, give birth to a child, and move to Nevada. Now, my mother thinks she's crazy. And my sister thinks this is the way life is. And part of that is the difference in who my sister looks at about what women are doing. Now, to make this a little more... more specific, the other data that we have shows that just in a period from 1976 to 1988, 12-year period, we went from a point in time in which the women who had given birth in the last year, only 30% of them were working. By 1988, 51% of women who had given birth in the last year were in the labor force. Now, many of these would have been part-time, but they were in the labor force. Now, sociologists would describe this kind of behavior as the experience of normlessness, in the sense that you have half the women giving birth doing one thing and half the women giving birth doing another thing around a fairly significant behavior. So we're living in a society in which there is a lot of conflict and discussion about appropriate behavior as we move out of an old way of doing things into a new world. Now, we might want to ascribe this change to perhaps feminist ideologies that are freeing women and opening things up. But in fact, if we look at what's happened over these three decades, while the feminist ideology may certainly have some effect, we have to recognize that there has been a major shift in the structure of society. It's interesting that during the 70s, as people looked at what was happening with women, they typically described this experience of women moving into the workforce as women fleeing neighborhoods and homes devoid of any intellectual discussion or interest. And that the primary reason that women were leaving home was because it was boring. Now, one of the things that's interesting is most of the sociologists who were giving those statements, saying those things, were men, which gives some idea of what they thought about how much they valued domestic things and children. In reality, I think the way we need to look at what's happened is that there was, particularly during the 80s, there was definitely a push of women into the workforce because of need and a pull of women into the workforce because of opportunity. Now, the push of women into the workforce because of need was primarily economic. During the 80s, thanks to, you all know who we can thank. there wasn't a whole lot of growth in discretionary income. and in family income. And in fact, during the latter part of the 80s, there was a decided decline in family income. And for many households, the only way in which they could maintain their level of economic viability was for women to move into those slots. The other thing that was interesting was that there was a whole slew, an expansion of the job market in an area that was particularly suited for women, in the sense that they were generally low-skilled jobs, part-time, and paid little. So what you have is created out of this, and very much, particularly in the American experience, a function of the changing capitalist corporate environment, you change society. Now, Kathleen Gerson, in a book called Hard Choices, How Women Decide About Work, Career, and Motherhood, has done a very interesting piece of work. In it, at the very conclusion of her book, among other things, she asked the question, what is it that encourages women to take on the domestic role? And she suggests that societies in which women take on a domestic role are societies characterized by these four things. Number one, a family system characterized by permanent stable marriage. Societies with high divorce rates are not generally described as having family systems characterized by permanent stable marriage. So we go through an experience of very high divorce rates, which puts many women out there being responsible for their own income. And the no-fault divorce laws that were very much in vogue, many sociologists have discovered that it really left women holding the bag in terms of care and responsibility for children. And so there's a whole effort to re-look at that no-fault program in terms of what it does to women and children. And I'm sure this audience is aware of the grave problem that we have now of the feminization of poverty, that when we talk about poverty, we're primarily talking about women and children. Secondly, a household economy founded on a one-paycheck male family wage. The idea being that the jobs that are available are sufficient such that one person can take that job and support a household. Now, many of our graduates from colleges these days are surprised to find that their initial incomes from the jobs that are available, despite their college income, is around anywhere from $16,000 to $20,000 a year, which is not sufficient given the level of lifestyle that many of them are used to. The third one, limited work opportunities for women. That is, women are encouraged in domestic to value the domestic and to stay in domestic situations to the extent that they don't have opportunities elsewhere. And that is not true. Corporations want to hire women. And those corporations include the LDS Church and Brigham Young University. Fourth, sufficient behavioral similarity among women to provide mutually reinforcing support for female domesticity. And this gets back to what I demonstrated before, that to the extent that most other women have the opportunity to stay home and limited work opportunity, there is a norm out there about what women do. And that norm, societal norms, are fairly strong around that. So what we have then is, in the past 30 years, particularly, a major shift in the type of society in which we live. Now, let's move to the implications of these changes. I'm going to turn this off and you can turn the light on so I can see my notes. One of the reasons that Gerson attempted to write this book was that as she looked at sociological theories that were available to describe women's lives, She saw most of them were very much focused on the difference in men's and women's lives, very little research focused on the difference among women. And the research that you can draw upon sociologically to describe the difference between men and women's lives are either primarily socialization, which says women want to raise and care for children because they've been socialized to do that, men want to work because they've been socialized to do that, or a structural approach, which basically argues that women are denied access into the larger society, prevented from moving out of the household, and in fact are encouraged to remain in the household to provide everything her husband needs as he goes out and works and does the things that organizations need done. As Gerson looked at this, she says this: despite enormous intellectual advances, neither established theories nor emerging feminist alternatives convincingly explained the changes currently taking place in women's social position and personal experience. Whether these theories stressed hormones, psychological predisposition, capitalist economic arrangements, or male oppression, they tended to focus almost exclusively on forces beyond women's ultimate control. What Gerson wanted to do was understand how women made choices within the context of their lives. Now, it may not be significant to most of you that sociologists were unable to describe that, but I would say that if sociologists didn't know that women were making different choices, then I suspect that there wasn't a clue among you, because we know what we're talking about. But anyway, so Gerson set about with a small sample of 63 women, mostly living here in Northern California. You know what they say about Northern Californians, so we don't know how generalizable it is. I'd never say that to a group in Minnesota, I promise. Anyway, she wanted to understand how women chose between what she calls domestic versus non-domestic careers. She notes that despite the dominance of women who fully expected and wanted a domestic career in their initial sample, by the end of the choices they had made, only 25% of her sample were actually full-time homemakers. So she asked, did these women make choices consistent with their socialization? And says resoundingly, no, they didn't. They did things different from what they were socialized to do. She asked, did these women's choices, were they consistent with the male patriarchal image of what women should do? And she answers, no, not necessarily. Did these women make choices constrained by the circumstances of their lives? Yes. And what are those factors that were most significant? Well, the number one most significant, she says, was that whether or not the woman had a stable relationship with a male partner that was focused on bearing and rearing children. That women who were unable for whatever reason to have that kind of stable relationship ended up making very different choices. Now, what that means is we're both talking about women who ended up divorced, expected to be very domestically oriented and ended up being divorced, women who expected to marry and never married, or because that was the dominant socialized expectation. And in fact, one of the things that she discovers is that she discovers a group of what she calls reluctant mothers. These are women who really wanted careers. They wanted to be out there and in the workforce, and formed a relationship with a man expecting not to have children, but because of the relationship that developed with the man, and they talk about it in very loving ways, finally decided that they would take on the responsibility of motherhood because the man that they loved wanted children so badly. And that part of what then continued was a full range of negotiations around responsibility based on that decision. The second thing she discovered was that some of these women, even the women who had focused on a career, developing a career, found that particularly the women focused on building a career, found themselves blocked in organizations. They had no way in to do what they really wanted to do. Or as they got into these male-oriented organizations, they felt alienated and alone and unfulfilled. And that in terms of the cost-benefit analysis they went through, that they made the decision that they wanted to give the domestic effort a try. There were other women who tried the domestic thing because they were socialized to do that. They thought they would like it and found it confining and eventually moved out into the workforce. So the second thing she says is simply blocked versus expanding workplace opportunity. The third factor she found was the availability of economic support for males, that there were a number of women who entered the workforce either because of divorce or because their husbands could not support them economically, and that these women particularly had to deal with the guilt and the frustration of meshing what they had been socialized to understand about what women's experience was with or what women's role should be with their actual behavior, which meant that they were working during the day and having to make other arrangements for their children. And finally, she says the fourth factor was the perceived cost and rewards for pursuing domestic lifestyle, that those who found the domestic lifestyle very rewarding, had economic support, had been blocked from the workplace, and had a very stable relationship were choosing a domestic lifestyle. But one of the things she discovered was not many of the women in that sample had all of those opportunities. Again, I'm focusing here primarily on structural characteristics, simply to point out that you have that societal structure and your location in that structure is very important determinant of how you make decisions. And Gerson accepts that and demonstrates that. But that women generally create, they make choices within those constraints. And having made those choices, they typically rethink their ideas about motherhood and women's place within the world. Let me give you an example out of Gerson. She's talking here of reluctant mothers. Again, these are the women who had fully planned to have a career, these are not reluctant mothers. These are the mothers who wanted a domestic lifestyle but were forced into the economic sector. She says, fear, guilt, and doubt were especially common, particularly among those who lacked the moral and financial support of a male partner. Given their lack of other acceptable alternatives, guilt and doubt, however deeply experienced, did not thwart these women's determination to combine work and child-rearing. Instead, they emphasized the benefits working mothers offer their children. They turned the traditional ideology on its head and began to develop a new philosophy of mothering that hinged upon the conviction that, at least in some instances, full-time mothering can actually harm children. I'm sure you've heard this logic. Inherited beliefs and prevailing theories notwithstanding, these mothers concluded that their own children would be better off because they would be mothered less. Reluctant mothers came to believe first that an unhappy mother would produce an unhappy child. If full-time mothering produced disastrous consequences for the mother, it would produce disastrous consequences for the child as well. This divorced bake officer concluded that a hired but happy caretaker was preferable to a miserable full-time mother. The questioner says, "Has working interfered with your ability to raise a family?" She answers, "No, because if Janet and I had stayed home together, we would have driven each other nuts. I would not have been as good a mother as I am now. Thank God there are all these loving people who are willing to watch my child when I'm gone and give her certain things that I'm not ready or able to give." Work-committed mothers argued that they would bring energies, ideas, experiences, and resources to child-rearing that full-time mothers could not offer. An accountant reasoned, "I think that if I'm challenged and alert, it's something I could probably communicate to my children." These mothers believed that their absence could and would be offset by benefits they were uniquely positioned to provide. Now, the only reason that I give you that example is to point out a major finding, I think, from Gearson's sample, is that as these women who find themselves in very different locations in society begin to understand their experience and to create their own paradigms, what you do is you get a natural creation of conflict. Because you get women doing different things, and what one woman does is a threat to another woman's choice. Partly, too, because we're involved in questions of core values. What is it that we really value in the society? Let me just read a portion from Gearson again. "Alternatives for women have expanded, but gender inequality persists. Some women have benefited from the expansion of avenues outside the home, but many have not gained access to such felicitous circumstances. For these women, eroding domestic supports undermine their traditional protections without offering offsetting gains. These dual trends underscore the paradoxical nature of things in women's position. Some have gained, some have lost, and most have gained in some respects and lost in others. The contradictory nature of these changes has created new social cleavages, new sets of opposing interests, new political conflicts, and new social problems. The deepening divisions among women and between traditional and non-traditional households throughout the class structure are as significant as conflicts between men and women." So what we have at the same period in which we have the growth of the feminist movement and the raised consciousness about gender, we also have occurring underneath that, and almost invisible in some cases except to the women themselves, the creation of conflict between women. Domestic women whose interests remain lodged in traditional family forms understandably fear the erosion of the protections offered by traditional arrangements. Non-domestic paths for women, however, are too long in the making and too deeply rooted to dissolve in the face of this opposition. They also guarantee that women's demands for equality will continue. These demands stem as much from new forms of female economic and social vulnerability as from a more general desire for liberation. Divisions between those who embrace new patterns and those who oppose them will thus continue to generate intense political conflict over women's, men's, and children's proper places in the social order. Now, as I develop this theme of women creating paradigms or worldviews based on their life circumstances and the increasing diversity of what those life circumstances are, I want to diverge momentarily to a very interesting book recently out called Rachel's Daughters, Deborah Kaufman at Northeastern University, just out Rutgers Press. She, too, is suggesting that sociological theories emphasizing socialization and structure miss the diversity of women's experience. Partly this is because sociological theories developed out of male experience. Her research tells us that women create and express a reality different from the reality of the male-dominant cultural group. And it's particularly interesting because what she chooses to do is interview newly Orthodox Jewish women. Now, what this means is these are women, many of whom actually participated in much of the counterculture of the feminist movement in the 70s, who convert to Orthodox Judaism. Now, if that's insanity from the point of view of a Mormon, you can imagine the insanity from the point of view of an Episcopalian. But let me read to you the example she gives of how these women make sense of their lives, given the fact that they have chosen to place themselves back into a very ritualized community, which on the outside we would suggest, and from the point of view of the patriarchy, is devaluing of women. Let me give you some experiences. She says, for many, the dark side of individualism had become a real, not merely abstract or theoretical problem. Freedom at the expense of commitment was a theme prevalent in many of the interviews. Secular versions of liberal feminism were not satisfactory either. Several women made comparisons between their feminist experiences and the ways in which Jewish orthodoxy spoke to them as women. Let me give you those quotes. You know, before I became Orthodox, I was in a feminist consciousness-raising group. We talked a good deal about our problems, about being women, students, lovers, and working women. We talked about whatever it was that was going on in our lives at that time, but we never really were able to formulate anything beyond or larger than ourselves. We were good at defining the negatives. I needed something that spoke to me directly about being a woman. Another woman put it this way. In Judaism, there is a positive assertion of who we are as women. The older I get, the more I realize how good that is. I have found meaning in all of this ritual, meaning I have never really had in any other time in my life. Torah has so much to say to me as a woman. My feelings about myself as a sexual person. The family purity laws are so in line with me as a woman. It is commanded that I not be sexually taken for granted, that I have 2 weeks each month for myself. It is mind-boggling to me to think that this wonderful Torah knows who I am as a woman for centuries. Now, let me briefly comment on this notion. You realize that it's the patriarchy still who's setting which 2 weeks this woman is not able to have sex with her husband. I think we need to recognize what's going on here. But the other thing we need to recognize is these women have created for themselves something that is not exactly explained by Marx's notion of false consciousness, in the sense that they give a completely total interpretation of what's going on that is different from what the patriarchy would say. And I think you find this among Mormon women. Now, let me read you one other. Even in the academic profession, where you supposedly have intellectuals, thinking, intelligent human beings, there is so much that I call corporate backbiting, gossiping, moving upward and almost always on someone's back. Individuals making it isn't what it is all about. Is my happiness, my fulfillment, my success the only important thing? Even family life has succumbed. How can we call ourselves a child-centered society when there is so much neglect and brutality? The world needs more of what we do as women naturally. We must teach and guide men. You know, in Orthodoxy, women are not required to do any of the time-bound commandments, the mitzvahs. Men need the discipline. We don't. Now, is there any ringing in your ears on this? Men need the discipline. We don't. We are closer to God. We are the Shekinah, the indwelling of God. We provide understanding. Knowledge alone means nothing. We have a natural understanding of things. We don't need to go to the synagogue 3 times a day or study regularly to fulfill our bond with God. Our discipline is in the everyday actions of our lives, in our intuitive understanding of what is right. In Judaism, this is recognized. Now, it would be interesting to carry on a fairly long debate about the implications for that. But what I want to do is move away from that to the Mormon woman's experience. Having, again, emphasized that what we've got is the creation of multiple paradigms given the situations in which these women find their lives. Martha Beck, currently at Brigham Young University, who is completing her dissertation at Harvard, has chosen to study Mormon women. And her preliminary information, I think, is very interesting in light of what we hear from Gerson and Kaufman. She interviewed over 300 LDS women all over the country. And she divides them basically into 3 groups. Initially, she divides them into the 2 extreme groups, the one she calls extreme groups. The one having a patriarchal viewpoint, which is embedded in the Judeo-Christian heritage that a woman's place in the home. And the other, the egalitarian viewpoint, that women should be granted equal rights with men to choose and direct the course of their own lives, and that they have been unjustly prevented from doing so in the past by subjugation, subjugating structures of a male-dominated world. Now, let me describe for you, read for you her description of these 2 different groups. The 2 of them together make up about 30% of the population.
that she interviewed. Traditional women describe gender role conflict as being created by forces within and outside the church, which they felt were working to tear down the traditional image of women. Feminists, Mormon or not, were referred to by the traditional women in my sample as evil, satanic, or deceived. There was more than an ideological fervor to their rejection of feminism. Traditional women felt that they were being slowly stripped of access to social rewards by policies based on feminist ideals. Again, we get that conflict that Gerson points out. These women see themselves as far better off within the patriarchal family than outside of it. They do not want to be removed from their position as experts in child rearing, a job that guarantees their social value. On the other hand, having accepted a position of dependence, traditional women rely to a great extent on a social system which treats that dependence as viable. As one Mormon woman put it, "When I was growing up, you didn't work, you know. You made yourself into a good wife and mother, and you could trust a man to see you through because of that. Nowadays, women are supposed to go out there and work just like men. So you see, the men don't feel they have responsibility to support their wives. Now, that's just wrong. It's wicked. And that's what these women's livers did for us." Now, the women's livers at whom this subject leveled her criticism, and I'm again reading from Beck, are also represented in the LDS Church. These women shared the traditional with the traditional woman the characteristics of dividing the world into dissimilar spheres of moral absolutism and of tending to generalize their own conclusions. When they were asked, "What is it like to be a Mormon woman?" they also described themselves as forming in contradistinction to men, according to what they were allowed to be. These feminists, however, felt that they had been allowed far too little. They reject the limitations of traditional stereotypes and saw themselves as engaged in a righteous struggle to alter the social and religious power structures which they believed relegated them to an inferior social position. So she would say that a minority of Latter-day Saint women, about 30%, she could divide into these two groups. They showed tendencies toward a dichotomous vision of social reality and gender. They were themselves divided into a group which shared the moral position of patriarchy in Western thought, and another which sided with the egalitarian feminist position in the secular debate on women's roles. Both groups were inclined toward moral absolutism and accordingly took an evangelical stance in discussing gender role conflict. Each group described the other as being responsible for this conflict. Each group saw the way they had chosen to enact their gender role as the best way in which all women could maximize their access to social rewards and therefore personal well-being. Both types held to the philosophy that those who are not with us are against us. Traditional women believe that all those who lack their absolute adherence to a patriarchal standard belong to the feminist group, and the feminists assume that all non-activist women sided with the traditional group. Now, what's interesting is that, this is 30% of the women. Where's the 70%? What are they experiencing? Well, this is, I'm reading again from Beck. These women perceive their conflict not as a fight to alter social structures in a way that will enhance their ability to obtain the social rewards generally recognized by the social sciences, but as a burden of responsibility to make choices which will enable them to preserve the integrity of their identities and their relationships in the face of divisive forces. While the traditional egalitarian debate focused on winning a war against immoral definitions of gender roles, these other women see the war itself as immoral.